Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon, former journalist, currently running for Congress in New York's 1st District. But this podcast series is about the need for us all, in journalism and politics, to focus on solutions, not just fixate on problems, because that creates a more empowered citizenry in a democracy. And today I am joined by a dear friend, John Haidt. He's a professor at NYU Stern School of Business. He is the author of many books, The Righteous Mind, and most recently, The Anxious Generation, a New York Times bestseller that has kicked off a revival of the idea that bipartisanship can indeed exist, particularly when it comes to protecting the mental health of our kids. And I would argue, have a positive impact on our ability to deliberate in this very distractive democracy today. John Haidt, it is good to talk to you, my friend.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, John. Even in my darkest moments about the future over the last 10 years, I always look to you for hope, for the belief that actually, if we just roll up our sleeves and get working, we can actually solve problems. So let's go. I'm going to roll up my sleeves with you.
Let's do it. I want to organize this conversation in three parts so folks know what to listen to. The first is what they can do, what we can do individually and for our kids to combat the excesses of social media that's leading to this epidemic of mental health crisis and self-harm and et cetera. The second is what schools and states can do, and indeed what they're already doing, in large part in response to your work in the book. And third, what Congress can do. And at the very end, we'll talk about the Unum test, which is an essay you and I wrote together that remains a guiding star for me. But let's start with the first. What can people listening do to help pull their kids back from their brink and even help themselves in this distracted digital democracy we have?
Okay, so I love these three sections, but I think we have to spend a few minutes on identifying what exactly is this problem.
Sure.
What is it we're trying to solve for, and why is it so hard to solve? So in its briefest form, in The Anxious Generation, I start with this extraordinary fact that around 2012, rates of mental illness just shot up in America, and not just America, in many countries around the world, certainly all the English-speaking countries and in Scandinavia. And there's no known explanation for this. The only thing that fits is that that's right when the world was switching over, kids were switching over from flip phones to smartphones, switching over from not high-speed internet to high-speed internet, switching from no front-facing camera to front-facing camera. So I call that period, 2010 to 2015, the great rewiring of childhood. The millennials got through puberty before it. That's why their mental health is generally okay. Whereas Gen Z is defined by the fact that they were trapped, they were caught, they went through puberty on the phone all day long. You can't be on a flip phone all day long. But our young people are now on social media 5 hours a day and total screen time on their phones 8 to 10 hours a day. And that pushes out almost everything else in life. It fills up every moment of consciousness that it can possibly fill up, you know, on the toilet, in the elevator, while standing near friends. Some of my students even take their phones into the shower now that the iPhone is waterproof. So it's a transformation of childhood that seems to be blocking development in many, many ways. So the way I'd like to frame the problem is not just, what do we do about social media? The problem I'm working on is, how do we roll back the phone-based childhood, which is a complete disaster for human development? Kids can't grow up on a phone. A phone can be a part of your life, but it can't be half or more of your life. How do we roll back the phone-based childhood and restore a more play-based childhood? We can't just take away the devices. We have to give kids a way that they can be out unsupervised. That's very important. Unsupervised. Just the way we all were when we were 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. That's when you have adventures, you learn out with other kids, not having the adults look out and make decisions for you. So that's what we have to change. We have to change childhood. Let's keep that as the big picture. Now, what do you want to ask me?
The reason I think that a podcast like this is needed is because what you just explained is an epidemic that people are feeling and experiencing in their own lives. And indeed, I'll just let you know, a member of my own campaign team, Ben, a member of Gen Z, told me today that when he read The Anxious Generation, everything clicked for him. And he said he thought it's the most important book he's ever read about his generation and the crisis facing our country and kind of undermining it from within. But I want to start with how to fix it on what people can do at home, what they can do themselves for their kids, including collective action between parents outside of the state or federal government. To begin addressing this. And you've got some concrete solutions.
Sure. Let's start with what you can do at home, what parents can do. So first, Well, if your kids are very young, if your kids are below 6 or 7, then what they care most about is you, and you really do have control over their environment. After that, they begin to care more about what the other kids are doing, and they're terrified of being left out, being the only one who doesn't have a phone. So let's start with the little kids. Now there, there's a lot you can do. We have been using devices as babysitters because they're so amazingly good. You want to do your email, you want to cook dinner, your toddler is pulling at your pants, wants attention. Oh, you know what? He's begging for your phone. Give him the phone. Everyone's happy. He's thrilled. You have 30 to 60 minutes to do whatever you want, and it seems that everyone wins. In Britain, it's now the case that 25% of their 5 to 7-year-olds have their own smartphone because we just think it's a babysitter. And we got tricked into this because we used to think computers were good for kids. They'll learn to program. They'll learn skills. But now it's not that. Now the device, it's all entertainment. It's all short videos. That's most of what they're consuming all day long, short videos. So I would say you want to go as low as possible on that. Probably nothing in the first 2 years. Experts say there's really no benefit. There's no baby Einstein. All that stuff is a waste of money and possibly backfires. So almost no video at all in the first 2 years. You know, FaceTime with a parent who's traveling, that's totally fine. But no video in the first 2 years. After that, the principle is that stories are actually good. Humans evolved with stories. We tell stories. So watching a movie with your kid is fine. Watching a 25 or 30 minute cartoon episode, either with or near your kid, is okay. It's the addictive stuff. It's the autoplay. It's the touch this to get more. So just be very sparing with younger children about video time. If you're on a long car trip and the iPad will help them, fine. A long car trip you can do. But what I'm learning from my students and what we're seeing more and more of is the human mind needs parts where stuff isn't coming in. We need moments to daydream. We need time to process. And I was shocked in class yesterday with my students. They don't have that. From the moment they open their eyes to the moment they close their eyes, they're consuming content always. And they agreed it makes them less creative. They don't have a moment to think. So don't let that start early on. Now, for older kids, once they're in, say, second, third grade, some kids are going to start having phones and they're going to say, Mama, can I have a phone? And this is where you begin to face the collective action problem. If it's just one or two kids who have a phone, you can handle it. But by fifth grade, sixth grade, your kid is going to say, Mom, everyone has a phone. I'm the only one. And so it's very, very important that you try to link up with other families. If you're the only one who's not giving a phone, it's going to be much harder for you and the kid. But if by, say, second grade, you contact parents of your kids' friends, other kids, and say, hey, there's a thing called wait until eighth. It should be wait until ninth, and they've kind of changed it. But go to wait until eighth, you can sign a pledge. But what I'm arguing is none of us should give our kids a smartphone until high school. Let's get this entirely out of middle school, early puberty. Let them get through early puberty. You can give them a phone watch or a flip phone if you're sending them out. If they're truly independent, unsupervised, and you want to be able to reach them, you can give them a phone that doesn't have the internet. But you've got to delay as long as possible a smartphone, and I suggest the norm of high school, and then delay social media till 16. We'll talk about that because there's a lot more to say about that. So that's the basic outline.
For those teenagers and even young college, I've heard you say that one thing they can do is turn off the notifications. Just make it less of a anxiety-producing distraction engine.
Mm-hmm. That's right. My students are, you know, young people in general, they don't seem to understand that notifications are bad because something good might come in. It might be important. There might be news in this. Oh, I'll subscribe to this. You know, I'll be part of this group chat. There might be something. I don't want to miss anything. And for each decision, you might say, oh, it just took a second or two to delete it. But my students get several hundred notifications a day. This is actually the average. 250 notifications a day is the average of what kids are getting now. Some are getting several thousand. If you're on multiple group texts, it could be several thousand a day. In other words, it's just constant interruption. They don't understand the need for deep work, the need to have a zone, you know, an hour in which you're working. Many of them have never had an hour without interruptions. So once I work with my students to turn off almost all notifications, you know, Uber, is it worth having Uber interrupt you to tell you that your car is coming? Yes, everyone says yes. Okay, what else rises to that level? Do you need to know if some movie star broke up? Do you need a breaking news alert from, you know, a magazine or mm-hmm. a website that something happened in Hollywood? Do you even need a breaking news alert for news stories? No. Look at the news once or twice a day. It's going to be much better for you. You don't need to be constantly drawn into everything that happens in the world.
So just a small tweak people can make to make themselves less sort of reactive. Let's talk about what schools and states can do, and indeed what they are doing on a bipartisan basis now, in no small part due to your work and your book.
Yeah, so I'm thrilled with what's happening. My book came out March 26th, and change began to happen all around the world. And the reason is because all around the world, family life has turned into a fight over screen time and everyone hates it. All around the world, teachers face the problem that unless they're more interesting than the most interesting thing on the internet, the students are going to pay attention to their phone. And so all over the world, students are texting, they're watching videos, some are watching porn, they're playing video games. They are not able to deal with boredom, and they don't have to because very few schools take away the phones. Most schools have a policy, you're not allowed to use your phone during class. That just means you have to hide it under your desk or in a book, is what my kids tell me from New York City public schools. So I'm thrilled that schools are acting very quickly around the world. Teachers have hated the phones for more than a decade. So schools are acting almost instantly all around the world, many countries, red states, blue states, to say, when you come into school in the morning, K through 12, you come to school in the morning, you put the phone in a pouch, a yonder pouch, or in a phone locker, or it could just be in a little envelope in the front of your homeroom class. It doesn't have to cost any money at all to do this. So this is happening at a mass scale, and every school has the same finding. I hear from so many, you read it in the newspaper, it's always the same thing. They say, we hear laughter in the hallways again. They say, the lunch period is loud. Kids are talking, laughing, joking. Before that, a lot of them are on their phones. So phone-free schools is happening at a mass scale. Broader picture, you're asking about states and schools. The key to my book is the analysis that we got into this by a collective action trap. We have to give our kids phones because everyone else did. And so we have to get out of it with collective action. And the four norms that I propose for collective action are no smartphone before high school, no social media before 16, phone-free schools, and far more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world. The first one is really up to the parents. No smartphone before high school. I wouldn't want to see a law on that. That should be a parental decision. We're Americans. We don't like government mandates unless there's a very compelling reason for it. So that is a norm that I think we can do on our own. The second one is the big one where we need government. We have minimum ages for addictive activities in this country, for graphic sex, for horrific violence, for things that are physically dangerous. When your kid begins to live on social media, all four of those are big, big risks. So it's completely bonkers. It's completely insane that we give kids this thing. You know, when you and I were kids, our parents wouldn't let us have a television in our bedroom. That was crazy. Like, right. If you have a television in the bedroom, the kid's going to watch it all the time. Well, the iPhone is 100 times more interesting than a television and 1,000 times more dangerous. But we just let that happen and with disastrous results. My point is, there has to be a minimum age limit on social media. It's just not appropriate for minors. The government should do that. Congress should do it, but they're very unlikely to. It would be hard to do. And so in the breach of that, in the absence of leadership from Congress, states are acting. Florida has passed a bill. They're going to impose a minimum age of 16 and put some responsibility on the platforms to police the age, which is where it ought to be. My point is, schools and states are the place to do collective action because the U.S. Congress is so dysfunctional, so unable to pass even a simple bill like COSA, which puts minimal protections on for kids. The House, it looks like they might block that.
We'll get to that in a second. I want to tell the more positive story because this is happening on a bipartisan basis in states.
Yes.
And it's not just Florida, right? It's Kathy Hochul in New York has proposed this. I mean, that's what's hopeful to me is that you and I have for years decried the death of bipartisanship, but this is an area where we're seeing real bipartisan support.
Oh, it's thrilling. It is thrilling. Just when I thought we couldn't do anything, red state and blue state governors are reaching out to me personally. I'm having phone calls with them. Their legislatures are red state, blue state, purple state. Virginia is, I think, going to be a model for how to do phone-free schools and get buy-in from all the communities working together. So yes, this really is. Just when it seems that we can't do anything bipartisan, it turns out Republicans and Democrats all have kids. And it turns out that their kids are all addicted to phones and social media. And it turns out that we're all disturbed by this. We all see this horrible thing happening, and we didn't know what to do about it. And we're all stuck in the same trap. Well, if I take it away, then she's isolated. She's alone. So we have to do this together, and I'm thrilled that we are doing it together.
We talk about collective action and voluntary collective action. Americans like freedom, and we like self-determination and equality, and those two things, all things can be intentioned. But the balance between individualism and community seems to have gotten tremendously out of whack, to the point where the epidemic of loneliness and isolation, the only antidote is community. And there's destructive community or there's positive community. When you tell me stories that the kids are laughing in the playground again and talking at lunch, that just highlights the profound alienation and isolation that we're creating, which makes people more susceptible to not just fear, but the appeal of extremism.
No, that's right. My book is a kind of a tragedy in two acts. In act one, we lose the play-based childhood. We stop letting kids out because we don't trust our neighbors. We're afraid they'll get kidnapped. And that's sort of 1990 to 2010. Act two of the tragedy is the arrival of the phone-based childhood, 2010 to 2015. Mm-hmm. But it's only as I was finishing the book and turning in the manuscript that I realized there's actually a third act, and it comes before the other two. Why did we stop letting our kids out in the 90s when the crime rate was plummeting, the world was getting safer and safer? Why did we stop in the 90s? And the answer is in Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. We had a lot of social capital, a lot of trust in this country, especially from World War II, that really builds a huge amount of social trust, social capital. It begins declining in the 70s. By the 90s, we have so little of it left. We don't trust our neighbors. We bring our kids in, and that's when things really begin to fall apart. If we're going to have American renewal, we're going to have to turn around this decline in social capital, in trust, trust in institutions, trust in each other. And so I think an important part of this, where government and families can be working together, is we can't just kick our kids out as our parents used to and say, get out of here. You know, don't sit here and watch TV. Get out of here. Don't come home till the streetlights come on. Don't come home until dinner. That's what parents used to say all over the country. And kids could go out and there'd be other kids, and then they would find someone to play with. Today, if you do that, either you'll be arrested or your kid will be picked up by Child Protective Services, because there's no one else out there. So we have to be more deliberate. We have to figure out ways to do this. And so an incredibly simple way to start for the younger kids is what we call the Let Grow Play Club. I co-founded an organization called Let Grow. We're having a session here on how to fix it. Part of the answer is you go to letgrow.org. I co-founded it with Lenore Scanese, who wrote Free Range Kids.
Right.
And because we know that parents are afraid to let their kids out on the street, but they do trust the school, we say, how about if the school just keeps the playground open from 3 to 5 p.m. every day? For, you have to sign up for it. So it's the same group of kids on each day. You know, you have a group that always plays together. Mm-hmm. So maybe instead of scheduling your kid for activities every afternoon, like with an adult, you say, oh, on Tuesdays, you get play club. And there's no structure. There's an adult nearby, but he's not supervising. It's thrilling. It's fun. So schools and families can act together to give kids more outdoor play.
I just think it also speaks to how starved we are for community. And it begins in childhood. But that's one of the things we need to do is rebuild a sense of community. Community over chaos seems to me to be one of the most urgent appeals we can make as a country right now. But I want to get to the third part, which is what Congress can do. I would have thought that we would have taken more congressional action on algorithm reform, social media reform, writ large, than we have to date, given the threats it faces to our democracy and our ability to reason together. But even with all the progress we're making in the states, on particularly focusing on childhood safety, we saw the Senate pass overwhelmingly the Child Online Safety Bill, right? Which is what you referred to as COSA. And they sent it to the House. And the House, unfortunately, characteristically, hasn't been able to get anything done, which is so surprising given the bipartisan support. Who doesn't want to protect their kids? So explain to folks what Congress can do, what it should do, and why it hasn't yet.
Yes. So the situation, as I understand, I spent a day, you know, meeting with some Congress people and trying to say why I think they need to pass it. And what I learned is that Meta in particular, but there a lot of them are working together. You know, they have huge PR budgets. They spend, you know, vast sums on lobbying. They employ congressional leaders, former staff, so they know exactly how to get into these offices. And what Meta and others are doing is they're pushing a set of arguments that are false. One set inflames the right, one set inflames the left. And so they're trying to get people on both sides to say, to turn against the bill. So for the left, they say, social media is a lifeline for LGBTQ kids. What would they do without it? And COSA hurts trans kids. That's a talking point you might hear. It's pushed by Meta. It's nonsense. Zach Rausch and I did a survey. There's a lot of data on this, a lot of different studies. LGBTQ kids, it's true that they will seek out information more on social media, but they also say that they have been more harmed by it. They're much more likely than any other group to experience harassment, grooming, sexual predation than any other group. And the internet allows you to find information. If we had a minimum age of 16, they could still find information with Google and the rest of the internet. So
to your point, put a pin in that. Explain people what COSA proposes, what COSA would do, what the Childhood Online Safety Act would do.
COSA establishes that these companies have what's called a duty of care. At present, they can exploit the hell out of them. They can do whatever they want. They, in fact, have congressional immunity because of Section 230 and COPPA. Congress passed two bills in the 90s that said to the companies, you can do whatever the hell you want. No one can sue you. You can show whatever you want. No one can sue you. You can do this with nine-year-olds as long as they say they're 13. The law says you can treat them as adults. So Congress passed these horrible laws in the 90s to let the internet grow with no guardrails whatsoever, and it has imposed zero guardrails, zero safety ever, ever. And our kids are paying the price for it. COSA does a few things. It mandates setting privacy settings have to be set to high. You can't have a kid on and then strangers can find them and start a conversation with them. It requires them to be careful about the limited set of kinds of content about suicide, eating disorders, things like that. So it's a very basic bill. It's not asking that much from the companies, but they refuse to do anything. They say, oh, this is the parents' choice. It's the parents' responsibility. And we can't handle it. We can't keep our kids away from social media unless we don't let them anywhere near the internet. So Congress needs to do this. And just briefly to the right, they say, oh, COSA is going to allow pro-choice people to shut down any pro-life content. It's going to allow censorship. So they keep saying censorship, censorship to the right. They keep saying historically marginalized communities to the left. And as I understand it, it's stuck in Speaker Johnson's court. If anyone can put any influence on him, that seems to be where the lobbying point, the sticking point, the pressure from Meta is coming. It's up to him.
It's stuck in Speaker Johnson's court. And
I believe that's the case.
Well, no. And look, I mean, he's the Speaker of the House. And unfortunately, we've got sort of a do nothing record. And there was more bipartisanship bills passed when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker. But let's talk about what else could pass. I mean, there was, you know, Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, gave very persuasive testimony. Again, it seemed like there were a number of bipartisan bills more broadly about algorithm reform. And that gets to something near and dear to my heart, our heart, but sort of defending our democracy from digital disinformation. What kind of bills do you think Congress can and should push forward on that front?
Yeah. So that's much harder. And this is where I get pessimistic, because the issues about protecting kids are totally nonpartisan, non-controversial. We should be able to protect kids. So if we can't do this, if we can't do this basic, simple thing of COSA, well, the democracy reform stuff is usually not bipartisan. It's usually going to be the case that one side or the other thinks this is going to help them. And so, you know, what we need would be, especially with AI coming, mandating watermarking of materials, marking things that have been manipulated or that AI, you know, done with AI. And it's more the sort of the right, especially the libertarian side of the right, that is very powerful with a lot of lobby groups, some funded by Meta, that is pushing back saying, no, you can't, you know, anything you do is going to be restriction on speech. You can't shut this, you know, just shut this down. And one of the big problems is that during the COVID epidemic, the left or the medical establishment really did shut down a lot of stuff on the right. That was correct. The left really blew the COVID response online. So the right doesn't trust the government to do things fairly.
Are there any bills that you think make sense to you as an expert, however aspirational they may be? And I remember there were some bipartisan coalitions around this. I think John Thune and Blumenthal.
Yeah. And other people. So The most productive way to think about this, I think, or to investigate small steps that we might actually take, is to follow Frances Haugen's advice, where she said, anything about content, like moderating content, okay, that's going to be controversial, tricky. But what we can do is we can change architectural features of the platform that end up disproportionately promoting the worst stuff. Mm-hmm. And so one example she gives is with Facebook groups, as I understand it, you can invite a certain number of people, you can invite as many as you want to join a group. And the groups that send out mass numbers of invitations tend to be the most conspiracy-driven, crazy groups. And so Francis said, what we need is just a speed limit on virality.
Yes.
It's not limiting anyone's speech. It's just you can't grow a group at a rate of, you know, 1,000x a day or whatever the limit is. You know, so she proposes, think of it that way. And the great thing about these kinds of reforms where you're limiting virality, you're limiting features of the platform, is they are content neutral, they're politically neutral, mm-hmm. they don't target or hit one side or the other, and they're language neutral, because Facebook is the internet in much of the world. Facebook is extremely influential all around the world. Research is beginning to indicate that social media is making it harder for democracies to be democracies. And so whatever reforms we do, if we could help those that are not just in the English language, that would be an amazing contribution to democracy around the world.
That is such a hopeful thing. And it's a way of thinking about the problem, right? Creating sort of process reforms that are neutral on value, but that limit the ability of disinformation, as it were, or people to game the system. The other thing that struck me that you said, and this is something that you and I have talked about a lot, is that the lobbying effort to stop the bill, which has broad bipartisan support for moving forward, plays off the far left and the far right. It plays to the base to deny the center. And that's the larger problem you and I have been talking about, right? And we wrote an essay, it was ultimately published in Time magazine with our friends Maya McGinnis and Mickey Edwards, called The Unum Test. And it, for me, has been sort of a close articulation guiding star of sort of our beliefs, how we can think about, beyond partisanship, what forces can help unite us and focus on those rather than those that divide us. I wonder if you would just talk about that essay and that approach to problem solving.
Sure. So, you know, so you and me and our friends, we have a small group that, you know, we got together in 2016, 2017, very concerned about the direction of our country. And we've been looking at different areas. What is it we need to do? And we said, well, you know, there are economic issues. We have too much inequality, and there are social issues. There's, you know, the far left is putting in educational policies that's alienating people on the right, and there are political reforms. So it was like, it was overwhelming. And like, there's what rent choice, like, what do we do? Like, there's too many possibilities. And so we came up with this idea that for every policy in every area, you can ask, if this policy were implemented, would it have the effect of increasing polarization and driving us further apart, or of increasing unum? We're all very taken with our national motto, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And that is a magic trick. That doesn't happen automatically. You have to do things to have that unifying spirit. An attack from outside, as in World War II, boy, did that do it. Now, you know, conflicts with China and other things, it's not clear it's going to unite us. So what we were thinking was, for everything, let's ask, is it going to unite us or divide us? Now, there are other considerations, of course, but that was the basic test.
Well, I think we thought about it in terms of political reforms, and there are things mm-hmm. like redistricting reform and open primaries and ranked choice voting, economics, you know, because it's become very clear to me that the hollowing out of the middle class has contributed mm-hmm. to the hollowing out of the middle of our politics and the policies yeah. that can do that. And that's been a major focus for me. And then the cultural ones, which include perhaps less obvious things, combating digital disinformation, yes, but also civics education, an expanded vision of national service, telling the unifying story, the good, the bad, and the ugly, but not from an oppositional view of American history. You know, that we are an imperfect force for good. We're imperfect people trying to form a more perfect union. And those conversations about civic education and an expanded vision of national service, perhaps in exchange for student loan debt forgiveness, those are things I find there is broad bipartisan support for. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah. People are hungry, starving for that sense of community. And that's why I think it resonates and remains a real guiding star for me.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see, you know, the bipartisan support of that isn't being opposed by any major companies. I mean, I don't think there are companies that are invested in us hating each other. Maybe there are. Whereas with protecting the kids, there are three or four or five giant companies that are going to lose a lot of money if they lose everyone under 16. So it'll be interesting to see whether you have more luck with bipartisan efforts where the problem really is the partisan divide. Like, okay, we don't trust each other, we don't like each other, but what can we do to make that better? That would be inspiring. And boy, you're the guy to do it, John. If anyone can stand there in the middle and try to bring people together, it's you. Vote for John Avlon. Well,
thank you. That's not the purpose of this podcast, but I appreciate it. You are a guiding light for those of us who are trying to rebuild the middle, restore some common sense. And with your book, The Anxious Generation, seeing that idea turn into action, confronting what we're all feeling and seeing as parents, how digital distraction is undermining our democracy and hurting our kids. And that's something we should all be able to agree on. And that's how to fix it. Jonathan Haidt, thank you for your work. Thank you for your service. And here's to rebuilding the middle together.
Let's do it together. Thank you, John.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us on How to Fix It. Delighted at the response to this very different new podcast, focusing on solutions rather than just fixating on problems. Please rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you back here next week on The Bulwark.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.